I believe that the real prospects for any kind of renewal of the radical left in South Korea, and I think this is true in virtually every major capitalist country, is a great internationalization of perspectives, because the recovery of the South Korean economy since 2008 has largely been based on economic dealings with China. There are 4,000 South Korean firms invested in China, and China has now replaced the United States as the main trading partner of South Korea. And it has replaced the United States as the main trading partner of Japan. So there's a certain kind of momentum. I do not want to be over hasty about this, but sort of a decoupling, maybe that's not the term I want to use, from an American-centered, export-oriented kind of economic strategy to something more Asia-centered. I believe it's in that context that the workers' movement itself really has to link up with, in the Korean case, with Japanese workers, and now, for example, with these recent very interesting strikes in June in China, to the extent it's possible, with Chinese workers. That's a difficult row to hoe, because you can't just go to China and say, you know, where's the nearest union office? Because the official unions, of course, are almost entirely controlled by the government and would frown on such overtures. But nevertheless, those kinds of connections are developing.
I've been speaking with Lauren Goldner. He is the author of a number of books, including most recently Herman Melville, Between Charlemagne and the Anti-Mosaic Cosmic Man, Race, Class, and the Crisis of Bourgeois Ideology, an American Renaissance Writer. He's also the editor of a new online journal called Insurgent Notes, and we also have a link to that. Thank you so much, Lauren, for being on the program.
Oh, it's been great.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the Antifada. Today we have a very special show. One of our good friends, comrades, and mentors, Lauren Goldner, has passed away this previous weekend. A legend within the communist milieu, a theorist inspired by left communist thinkers, by Marx, and by many others, as we'll be talking about on this episode. And the last of the professional revolutionaries, a man who lived all over the globe, a man who was part and parcel of the theoretization of struggles from California to New York, to South Korea, to China, Africa, Europe, and elsewhere. Lauren Goldner was an incredible figure. And as you'll see on this episode, we're going to have a bunch of his friends together here to reminisce, to talk about his thought, to talk about his theory and how they helped all of us with our development, and also just to celebrate the life of a man who was truly kind and generous with his own time, and just a good friend to us all. So welcome to the Antifada Lauren Goldner Memorial episode. Andy, you want to talk a little bit about the goings-on on this episode?
Sure. So I didn't know Lauren as well as you did, Sean, but I had seen him talk a couple times, and I've read a lot of what is available on his site, Break Their Haughty Power, and on Libcom, and he's one of the best writers of our milieu. He puts things very clearly, very emphatically, and just going over some of his stuff in the last few days after I heard the news, it's already been incredibly refreshing and helpful. He was very incisive about social movements. He's got a great essay about Seattle in 99, about Occupy. Like you said, he was writing about the strikes in South Korea, about the more recent labor movements in China. And this is just some of his work over the last 10, 20 years. And he had been working since the 60s, as far as I know. I think Guy Debord mentions him at some point. He had been relevant for that long. So I'm going to probably hang back on this episode since I didn't know him quite as well as everybody else, but we have some of his friends and comrades from Insurgent Notes, from Capital Reading Groups and other places, and really glad you could all join us and tell us more about Lauren and point our listeners in the direction of getting acquainted with his work.
Yeah, if I could start with my reminiscences. I first met Lauren, I think around the same time I met a lot of the folks who are going to be on this podcast, which was the immediate aftermath of the great financial crisis, a moment in time where there was a real rebirth of the critique of political economy aspect of Marx's thought. Whereas before, you know, it was very academic. It seemed very, very real to all of us. Lauren was living in New York City at the time. And I believe Billy might have been at this meeting and Jared might have been too, but he called a meeting and we all met at the Brecht Forum, rest in peace, which was like a sort of Popular Front Stalinist meeting center that existed, I think going all the way back to the boomer period on the west side of Manhattan. And we sat down and Lauren kind of led the discussion and we put together a reading list. And the idea of this group was to kind of have a recomposition of Marxist forces within New York City that could try to do a reading group and do theory to try to take from the past what was necessary to understand in that present. Lauren and I, after that group, we had had some meetings. We crossed each other's paths many, many times after that. He was always very kind to me. He, no matter how advanced you were, I think, your theory or your history or whatever, he was always very, very generous with his time and with his energy. If you ever had a question, you could email him. If you ran into him at a party or something like that, he would be glad to talk your ear off about whatever subject it was that you were interested in that particular time. And so in a social sense, interpersonal sense, just an extremely lovely man and a great friend, I would say. And as a mentor and a comrade, just somebody who lasted through some of the toughest times, I think, on the left communist or ultra left milieu, a man who kind of, you know, cut his teeth in the heyday of boomers 60s radicalism and spent the rest of his life carving a different path from the sort of third worldist Marxist Leninist Maoist way that much of his generation went. All the way back in the 60s and 70s, he was already critiquing that and kind of bringing to earth and holding on to important nuclei of communist theory, like Bordiga, like Kamat, translating things and making sure that this current of Marxist theory and practice, which we call the ultra-left milieu, or we could call left communism, councilism, Bordigism, had a life in the English-speaking world. Far in times like way previous to when we all know like the Bordiga memes and stuff, Lauren Goldner was working with this heavy theory and making it accessible to everybody. So in terms of, you know, how I would summarize his legacy to me, it was somebody who is a real exemplar, I think, of what a true revolutionary should be, which is a kind of glue that holds people together. A mentor that will bring people along, help them to understand the world, and also an open-minded person who could go everywhere from volume two of Capital to understanding the works of Herman Melville in terms of the birth of the modern world, the 1848 revolutions, and everything like that. So a real Renaissance man on the communist left. That's what I have to say.
So we've got a bunch of people on the call. A lot of people our listeners will be familiar with from past episodes, and that's no coincidence because Lauren was a mentor and you know, had brought together a lot of the people who are influential to Sean and I, and of course who we've had on the show for that reason. So who would like to speak first and maybe give us a little bit of a background on either how they know Lauren or Lauren's life or his thought?
John, I think you had a series of biographical sketches, right, that you had found earlier.
Sure. I, you know, like everybody, like on here, and just, I got a lot of texts actually from folks, being in shock that Lauren passed away. You know, he was ill for some time. But I think it's a shock because, as you know, Andy and Sean have talked about it, I think, you know, Lauren was a big mentor for a lot of us, you know, younger revolutionaries, I use younger broadly, we're older now, but kind of that that post-Occupy generation, well, the Occupy generation, right, who were really shaped by a very particular material conditions, that being the rise of what, you know, Lauren spent a lot of time talking about, fictitious capital, right, and why that was really important to understand in terms of, you know, how that would reflect the kind of struggles we would see, the kind of struggles we could anticipate participating in, why a lot of the social movements that, you know, the old socialist parties kept, you know, hitting their head against was no longer working, right? So I think, you know, Lauren was a really indispensable mentor for all of us. And like many of that generation, really, really friendly, very much approachable, someone who always made a lot of time for, you know, for us. But yeah, to just give a brief like biographical sketch. So Lauren was 76. His birthday was in October. He was a Libra, which we texted about at one point. But he was also a revolutionary, right? Born in October. He was born in Berkeley, California. His dad was a professor. And I think at some point he also lived in Bowling Green, Ohio. But he, you know, he really kind of grew up in the Bay Area. So he was really involved in, you know, a lot of the, you know, political upheavals of the late 60s. And I think, you know, he has this really interesting article that I sent to Sean as well, that hopefully readers will check out, that talks a little bit about his political upbringing. But he says, you know, he went to Berkeley to pursue his studies, and he found himself in the middle of all of these movements, right? And having to deal with, you know, kind of the Maoist left, the broad socialist left. And at that time, you know, people were in that sense choosing sides. And this was also the time of a lot of, you know, like Black radicalism, the Panthers, right? So he found his home in these independent socialist sects that were quite critical of Stalinism. And even though he would remain critical of Trotskyists throughout his life, I think he appreciated a lot of Trotskyist critique of Stalin. So this is all to say he kind of really comes out of that 68 arc. And I think it was at Berkeley that he found the Situationist, the, you know, kind of like the French left, and was really beginning, you know, his political developments, you know, and kind of become a main ultra leftist. And I thought what was interesting about Goldner's life is that he had this really cushy job at the Harvard Center for European Studies, which I think at the time had its own library. So he really spent his day like reading, talking about books, writing until the mid 90s. And then when he got laid off, he had to figure out what to do, right? So at this time, he makes his way to South Korea to teach English. And for a few years, he's back and forth to South Korea. And he's also traveling to other parts of the world. And what I got from, you know, talking to some folks is that wherever he went, he was really clear about making connections with, you know, working class struggles. And those were connections and comrades that he would maintain relationships for his entire life. And then afterwards, when, you know, he returned, he kind of settled into Brooklyn and in New York. A very short story, my personal, and I'll give it up to other people, is I met Goldner in 2015, I believe. This was during around post like Occupy time. And this was, I don't know if you guys remember, this is when he was giving those talks at Wendy's. I know, right? Like, what a place. So I met him through folks, you know, in the New York scene. And I was really taken by Lauren because he was not somebody that could just talk to you about politics. He could talk to you about anything. So we talked a lot about music, art, his life, the world. And I think he took special interest because, you know, being Albanian, you know, we were really the last existing socialist country and quite Stalinist. So I know he had a lot of stuff to say about that. But yeah, I'll give it to other folks to share.
Yeah, thank you for that. Who wants to go next?
Yeah, thank you, Jonah. That's really eye-opening. I remember Lauren telling me a story about being in Berkeley in the 60s. Of course, I'm Billy O'Connor, long time New York Capital Reading Group alumni, alumnus, and Lauren told me a story about being in Berkeley in the 60s, wheat pasting posters to a wall and getting arrested. The posters he was wheat pasting said, CPUSA are police informants. And the cops were like, wait, what? He's like wheat pasting these posters that say, the American Communist Party are police informants. So, you know, just by way of a slight, a short biographical anecdote, and to establish his leftcom bona fides, I guess. You know. But that was an excellent biography. John, thank you. I met Lauren around the same time as Sean. I was at that Breck meeting, and I remember going to him shortly after that and telling him, yeah, I had gone down to Katrina with the disaster relief, and I just was very disillusioned by the whole scene here in the U.S., frankly. And I told Lauren, I just don't have any faith in this American working class anymore. I just don't think they're ever going to get anything done revolutionary-wise. And he told me a story about this Catholic priest who went to his bishop and said, I just don't believe in any of this stuff anymore. You know, I don't believe any of it. And I have parishioners who count on me, who look up to me. What am I going to do? And the bishop leaned into him and he said, fake it. And that's it. And from then on, I always called Lauren the bishop and addressed him. I addressed him as Your Grace whenever nobody else was listening. But you're not recording any of this, are you?
Got it all, yeah. Billy. Yeah.
So that was that, you know? I don't care. He looked at me like, I don't care if you believe in it. Just keep coming to the readings. You know, it was a real turning point in my life. And, you know, I'm still out here faking it less. But, you know, I'll always think of Lauren as the bishop for that reason. So, yeah.
The following year, 2009, a small auto parts plant south of Seoul called Sangyong announced 1,500, 2,000 layoffs out of a workforce of 6,000. And they had already been downsized from about 8,000 a few years before. Interestingly, this firm was ultimately owned by a Chinese automotive company. The general idea was that the Chinese automotive company really just wanted to shut down Sanyong and take the equipment and move it to China. They were restructuring, laying people off, and then they announced these massive layoffs, and those who were on the list to be laid off occupied. And they held the factory for 77 days. Some workers who were not laid off also joined them. And the union, the local union president, stayed in for the entire 77 days. And they, after about 4 weeks, the police attacked, and then finally even units of the army were involved in the final assault of Sangyong. If you search it on the internet, I presume you can still find these video clips of military helicopters flying over the plant, dropping tear gas that, you know, had a special chemical element that burned the skin. They had cut off the water and finally even the electricity. They were very concerned because there was a huge paint department. And once they turned off the electricity, there was a greatly increased possibility of fire in that part of the factory. And the workers just sort of fought tooth and nail right up to the end until they were all trapped in one part of the factory, surrounded by thousands of riot police and soldiers, and they finally caved.
Yeah, I'd studied in, not studied, but taught in South Korea. And the one thing about Lauren is you could never tell him you went to a place or wanted to go to a place or thought about a place unless you wanted him to get you involved in some revolutionary work at that place. Because I told him, yeah, I used to study Korean and for some reason when I was in the military, the Korean language. And he said, oh, that's fantastic. And he had a whole list of groups and people in South Korea, South Korean communists who have to remain nameless. I think they still have the death penalty on the books in South Korea for being a communist.
Probably,
but they need some help. They need some help setting up their website and this and that. And he knew I had done a lot of computer work, software development work in the 90s. So you never told Lauren you knew about a place or you thought about a place because you're working in that place as soon as you told him. He'd send you to Brazil, South Korea. And he did. And, you know, I met a lot of people and learned a lot of languages hanging around with Lauren Goldner, because you would, you know.
Greetings. Yeah, I'll go. My name is Arya Zahedi. I've known all of you for quite some time. And Yeah, I've been really trying to think since I got the news how to sort of organize my thoughts. Lauren Goldner was a very big influence on my thought and in a number of ways that I'll talk about. I think first off, just to say that he will certainly be missed and that his presence and now him being gone, there's definitely a kind of a void, at least for me. And, you know, he was sick for a while. So just his kind of pulling back as things started to get worse was already a bit of a empty space. And I think that it just reminds me also again, and apart from him personally, like how I'll miss him personally, besides his, you know, intellectual and revolutionary and all of that, just on a, you know, personal friend level, I'll certainly miss him. I think getting back to this political level, he was very much of, or cut his teeth on that 1968 generation. Jana just really, I think, pointed out a lot of things like that, that we have to really appreciate that connection. And I think as time goes on, those kind of, you know, connections are sort of breaking a bit. Like many people of that generation, he became politicized, as Jana said, at Berkeley, but through SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, which in the late 1960s was the largest campus organization. And then I think he was involved with the International Socialist faction of SDS, which is Trotskyist faction that didn't accept the Soviet Union as a socialist country. They had their own sort of version of kind of some kind of state capitalist thesis. Somebody else might be able to fill in the blanks on that for me. But then went into that. And something really interesting he selected to point out about how he was always sort of wrong place at the wrong time. He was in Paris in April of 1968. Martin Luther King is assassinated. He says, the revolution is about to kick off in the United States. I need to get back. Oh. And he comes back to the United States. And May 68 is just a few weeks later, you know. And he had a number of stories like that. For me personally, I met Lauren Goldner. Sure, it was right after I moved to New York City, which was around 2007. I moved to New York City, and I met Lauren. I would think it's sometime around the crash. So shortly after that, but it was certainly before Occupy, around maybe 2008, 2009. And first time I met him was at a talk he gave on fictitious capital at the CUNY Grad Center. And then shortly afterwards, I heard he had a capital reading group. And I don't remember, it was so long ago, this capital reading group. Billy, I think that's where we may have met. You may have been in that one, which was in, I don't even know, it was some union hall in Midtown somewhere that you had to take a freight elevator up and go in, you know, couldn't point it out now. And it was out of that reading group that the basis of what became Insurgent Notes came out of. And I know Insurgent Notes existed when Occupy happened because we already had literature for it and all that. I get the sort of dates if somebody can fill it out. So, you know, I was from then on, I mean, from the time we had the Capital Study Group, he and I just kind of really hit it off in terms of friendship, intellectual interest, things of that nature. And a few ways that I think he really influenced me and we really kind of clicked on, I've tried to just sort of collect my thoughts. One thing is that we have to remember the era before the 2008, 2009 crash and after the fall of the Soviet Union was not very encouraging for the study of capitalism generally, let alone Marxist theory. And Lauren was one who really was a bit immune from whatever was the intellectual fashion at the time, for better or for worse sometimes. But it was his insistence that this is just temporary. Once again, the critique of political economy will see the importance, and his insistence on the importance of the critique of political economy, as he believed, and I think he was correct in his analysis, and Marx understood it, was still the key for us to understand the world around us. Not the only one. It is not in and of itself sufficient, but it is indispensable. And his insistence on that, and Marxism as a critique, not as an ideology, was something that really attracted me to his way of thinking at a time when, I mean, people who held that view, a lot of them were dead. You know, they were the thinkers of, you know, the critical theory of the past and of the sort of communist tendencies, minoritarian communist tendencies of the past. And stemming from that is the insistence that alienation is the pillar on which that critique of political economy is based. That's something he and I really, used to talk about all the time. And if, you know, I'm sure all of you can affirm this of how, you know, he could just open chapter verse Capital, you know, and be like, here it is. This is the it, you know. And that was always easy because he was such a source, you know. I'd be like, Lauren, this is what I'm doing. And he would just open the book and be like, this is the quote you need right here. And then even more directly in terms of my own work, I think two things that were key that I built upon, you know, even though, by the way, we did have our disagreements, but these were the things that I felt we both really were trying to develop theoretically, and what was a basis of our, you know, intellectual relationship at least, was one was the theory of imperialism and how to understand imperialism today, and the critique of we'll call the ideology of anti-imperialism, not the struggle against imperialism, what we call the ideologies and its various sort of offshoots. Lauren's essays, one on the Turkish Communist Party and the other on the influence of kind of this German anti-modernity thought on third worldism, which I think is even more relevant sort of today, and his essay on Bolivia. So those were sort of key for me. We did a panel together at the first New York. No, it might not have been the first. I don't remember what year it was. It was 2011. HMNY, Historical Materialism Conference, on this question. And, and that's when I first really started to develop what is today, like what I work on a lot is this sort of critique in terms of how it applies to Iran in various ways. And related to that, and I think what is a really important also sort of theoretical achievement of his is reaffirming the importance of Rosa Luxemburg in the theory of imperialism and the critique of anti-imperialism as both the basis of that critique, but also a new way of understanding imperialism in this whatever we want to call it, neoliberal, late capitalist era. And then another point that's connected to that is his interest, would put it mildly, in the struggles of the third world in the global South. I mean, the struggles of the proletariat in the global South. Sorry, get out of there. You know, as seeing that as being one of the major developments of capitalism since the 70s, the push of manufacture of the global South. So he's always interested in what the proletariat was doing, not just in the kind of core capitalist nations, but also even in the far peripheral aspects of international capitalist production. And so related to all that is an essay I would point to. I've already mentioned his, I want to sort of pitch these essays to people, perhaps maybe younger people who might be listening.
I'm so making a list.
Go look these up.
Yeah, I'm going to make a list so that they can all go on the show.
Essay on Bolivia, essay on Turkey. And another one that was really influential to me is A Fictitious Capital for Beginners or the Continued Relevance of Rosa Luxemburg. That's an essay that was really sort of influential to me and kind of set me along further down the kind of rabbit hole of this, basically emphasizing the continued relevance of the idea of a primitive accumulation, the continuance of, and that being the basis of understanding capital imperialism today. So on a personal, more kind of just to kind of talk about him as a person, sometimes I think, and this was, I think, no small part of his own doing, his insistence on the critique of political economy, particularly at a time at the sort of high period of postmodern theory, sometimes may have given the impression that he was sort of dogmatic, or that he was only concerned with this one kind of key aspect of capitalism, which sometimes that could be the issue. And I think it's because of who he was trying to sort of struggle against so much. But on a, you know, outside of that, he was very much a cosmopolitan thinking person who saw capitalism as this much more dynamic totality. And a couple of aspects of his thought that I think really go under the radar was that as much as he was a very much a critic of what we would call postmodernist theory, he was not simply a Marxist apologist of modernity and kind of 19th century materialism. He believed that Marx was neither the kind of, and I think correctly, the materialism of the 18th, 19th century thinkers, nor this kind of rejection, but he did believe that it was a possibility of there being another way. And his writings on, you know, Kepler, for example, he would always posit Kepler to Newton and say Kepler was the kind of alternative that could have provided a sort of more holistic view. And a kind of anecdote, one time I remember him telling me that he had by himself traveled to Amish country in Pennsylvania to scour really obscure bookshops in order to find the writings of Jacob Burma, the German mystic philosopher, which have a connection to those communities. So he really would go deep just to show, give an idea of, you know, sort of his interest in terms of thought and philosophy.
Did he find it?
I believe, yeah, he would tell these stories. Like, you got to go check it out. These bookstores, they're like Marxist bookstores with all their divisions, you know, and they have a whole section on, you know, 16th to 19th century mysticism. You got to check it out. And, you know, he knew German and they spoke. He could kind of make this medieval German up. And so just to give you a kind of idea. And so, you know, I think I've spoken enough, but just to say that I hope to sort of do justice to his memory. He will be missed. There will be a place which won't be able to be filled with his loss. So rest in peace, Lauren Goldner, and your commitment to what he called a true material human community, I hope will sort of continue, particularly, I hope that, yeah, I'll just sort of leave it at that. Rest in peace, Lauren Goldner.
Oh, great words, man. Thank you so much for that.
Those of you who are familiar with Hegel know about his glorification of the Prussian monarchy and the Prussian civil service as the embodiment of the world spirit. These German romantics, and Fichte in particular, had a variant on them. One, I think, without too much violence to history, can draw a line from Fichte's notions of the autonomization of the aesthetic in a revolt against Kantian philosophy, which we don't have time to talk about, and his idea of what he called the closed mercantile state, geschlossene Handelsstaat in German, which, you know, we find in the 1920s and 1930s, culminating in German Nazism, a literal closed mercantile state headed by a failed artist named Adolf Hitler, who devoted a tremendous amount of his time and power to art, aesthetics, and saw culture as central to Nazism. You know, those who see us as merely a political movement understand nothing about National Socialism, as he told the British ambassador just before the outbreak of World War II.
Next, Ross, do you want to jump in? Ross Wolf.
Yeah, so this is Ross. I've been on the Antifada a couple times. But yeah, Lauren, I came to know a little bit later than some of you on here. I'd read a couple of his essays, but when I first began to really engage with his writings in earnest, I was actually a member of the Platypus Affiliated Society, and we were organizing this talk on radical interpretations of the present crisis. This is early 2012. We began organizing this and began corresponding with different prospective panelists. So Lauren was one of those panelists. Paul Maddock was also there, David Harvey, and Andrew Kleiman of the Marxist Humanist Initiative. And it was a huge event. I think some really interesting exchanges. But I found myself, you know, most impressed by Lauren's remarks, as well as Paul's. And then, you know, in the years after that, you know, I found his website, I devoured his writings, really, you know, which had a huge influence on the way that I thought. I mean, it was already resonant with so many of the influences that I had prior to that, you know, Marx, Hegel, Kant, you know, the entire, you know, patrimony of Western philosophy, his, you know, I mean, so, like going over, you know, some of the essays that had a huge influence on me, his two-part essay for Race Traitor on Race and the Enlightenment is just phenomenal. He had a very early critique of post-colonial thought in the Universality of Marx. Some of his review of Max Albaum's book, Revolution in the Air, his own reminiscences of the 60s at Berkeley. And in fact, like, you're right, like, Arya, when you were talking about like some of his criticisms at the time, again, it's crazy to think like how early on he was kind of like, you know, sticking it to the postmodernists, the French post-structuralists. I mean, he was conversant with all that stuff, doing reviews of these obscure books in French that were challenging these currents of thought. So his book, The Vanguard of Retrogression, like I was rereading parts of it today, just in preparation for this memorial that we're doing here. And I was struck by, you know, I mean, there were parts of it where, yeah, he comes off a little bit dogmatic perhaps, but specifically dogmatically, like Marxist, Hegelian Marxist. Again, I love it. Jared's holding up The Vanguard of Retrogression, great book. His book on Herman Melville that I have, Jake Blumenfeld posted about it on Twitter. It really is unclassifiable. It's genre defying. Like, just, it's so erudite. It's, you know, it's going across the entire gamut of Melville's writings, you know, from beginning to end. It's incorporating, you know, reflections on the state of science in the 19th century, revolutionary movements in Europe. It's just incredible. He could range from that, this like incredibly erudite, you know, work of literary and social criticism, and, you know, deliver these very accessible sort of rundowns of revolutionary history at Wendy's. Really, like, it's listening back to them, reading the transcripts of them, like, he was just going off the top of his head. These were just like, I mean, he would occasionally like get a couple of the details here and there wrong, but that's because he was going entirely from memory. Really just one of a kind figure. You know, thinking of, and it's funny to think of him too in terms of like the New York like revolutionary milieu that I found him in. Obviously he lived in these other places as well. he had all these like kind of funny interactions with, you know, various others like in the ultra left milieu throughout New York. You know, I met up with him like probably four or five times individually. We corresponded a lot via email. And I did those couple of events, the one on interpretations of the present crisis. I did another event at Woodbine about class struggles in China, which he was really devoted to up to the end of his real, like, you know, intellectual output. But like he would tell me, like, another figure who sadly passed during the pandemic, McIntosh of Internationalist Perspective, who's an outstanding and incredible figure in his own right. They would have these like little like spats or disagreements. Like, you know, I remember this was like 2014 or 2015. We met up in Washington Square Park, and he and McIntosh had just had some disagreement over the character of ISIS, like which at the time was very much in the news. And they both agreed that ISIS was an essentially like modern phenomenon, that it was not just the recrudescence of like this past barbarism, that it was like there was something very new and perverse about it. But they were disagreeing about whether to characterize it as multinational, which I think McIntosh was, because of all the foreign fighters who were joining ISIS, or transnational, because it spanned like these different existing national entities. And I couldn't for the life of me see like what was at stake with this, but like he was very exercised about this exchange, and he just kept coming back to it when we were having a conversation. So I found that kind of really summed up his kind of interesting like friendship / rivalry with McIntosh and some of the others. I remember, and this involves, you know, another good friends. He was very close, of course, with Noel Ignatieff. Rest in peace to him as well. But just Noel would call me a lot. Like he would just phone me at, you know, weird hours of the day. And, you know, it was usually like talking about like arguments that he'd been having on Facebook or whatever, like stuff that was just bothering him. But Noel would call me because he said, like, basically having me act as like a surrogate for Lauren Goldner about questions of like national liberation, because he said like Lauren refused to talk to him about this after a while because they just had the argument so many times, like for years and years and years. And he was like, you've got basically the same like position on this as Lauren's. I just want to talk this over like once more. And I would just be like, all right, like fine. And, you know, we would talk for like an hour or whatever. So, I mean, this, like, again, that, I mean, it's a story about Noel, but I think it also involves Lauren in this kind of indirect way. So, I mean, just a hell of a guy, a true giant, like completely one of a kind intellectual, just completely sui generis too, like self-made, like autodidact, like with all these incredible connections. Just, you know, it's a huge loss.
Ross, thank you for that. I think next, maybe, I hate to do this, but Jana, do you want to jump back in? Do you have more to say after the biographical sketch, or should we move on to Jared or Joe?
In the interest of not taking too much time, maybe I could just add that at the end. But I think Jared, did it look like you were about to say something?
He wants you to go off, according to chat.
I can't see the chat. No, I was just going to say, I think to go back to like the 68, I just want to say that I think Lauren was like very emblematic of this like nascent ultra left of a time when, you know, and I think the essay, Ross, that you alluded to, where he like critiques that guy's like take on China, you know, it's like the anti-war movement in the 60s against Vietnam was like very unable to have a critique of Stalinism, you know. As much as I have so much respect for Noel, even Noel, you know, Noel didn't really have a critique of like Stalinism until much later. So I think, you know, Lauren in that sense was part of that wave of, you know, this critique of Stalinism. He was in this, like, you know, sort of Trotskyist sect that was able to say, like, hey, like, you know, the Soviet Union is not a socialist country. You know, also to have a critique of China, of Mao, and to kind of bring in, you know, to kind of look at May 68 in France and say, you know, in other parts of the world and say, like, okay, that's what we should be aiming for, right? So I think to kind of have that critique of Stalin as early as 68 in the U.S. is really important, you know, I think contribution of Lauren and of the 68 generation. And I just want to add that I think our discussion here is that Lauren had what we should hope for any revolutionary to have, right? This like very global outlook where he really took seriously struggles everywhere, right? I mean, when he went to South Korea, he was like meeting with workers and there, you know, like the working class struggles were not, were very much connected to working class people, right? Not like in the US where it was mostly a lot of academics. And he learned Korean, right? I think his most recent, you know, project that he didn't get to finish about China, right? I mean, he was learning Chinese. He was very much, you know, he in order to understand like the struggles that were happening, he really immersed himself in them. And he was, I think, really tried to connect himself to revolutionaries elsewhere.
There's a sense that the massive kind of police crackdown on demonstrations and strikes that was very typical of the government just were not going down well. For example, on the day I visited Zhongzhou, it just happened that about 1,000 scabs and thugs had held a demo just outside the plant gate, and there were about 400 cops there as well. And to everyone's surprise, and certainly to my surprise, the police declared their demonstration to be illegal and dispersed it. Not, of course, because they didn't sympathize with it, but because they were worried that the workers inside were going to come out and attack it.
Just a short story. He, you know, he was one of the people that put me in touch with like revolutionaries in Spain. When I visited, you know, the socialism or barbarism folks in France, right? So he was, I think, very connected and, you know, in this effort of, you know, what it really would take to build like a global, you know, working class movement.
Absolutely. Jared, I think you're next on deck.
What's up, everyone? It's great to see all of you.
Welcome back. Many time guest, Jared.
You know, as Engels said at the graveside of Marx, you know, he was before all else a revolutionist. And I think that that's really important to emphasize because he was such a magnificent intellectual, right? Ross pointed out some of my favorite of his work, actually. Race and Enlightenment is it's magisterial. And the Melville book, which I'm actually, I've just started to read since he passed, and I really wish that I had read it before so that we could have talked about it, right? It's just, I agree with Ross, it's unclassifiable. He was such a towering intellectual figure, capable of synthesizing 19th century art and science and politics and class struggle all coherently within the same thread. And simultaneously, he spoke at least six languages, I believe most of those he taught himself, or he would participate in these language sharing programs with people in New York City. And so it's easy to lose sight of the fact that that's probably the smartest person that I've ever met was not somebody who was dedicated to publishing as many books as possible on arcane intellectual topics or rising to the top of their some academic bureaucracy, but was very much engaged in just the practical exigencies of class struggle. And that's how he oriented his thought. That was the reason why he did all of the things that he did. I mean, he was not without ego, but it wasn't the kind of academic ego that you find among Marxologists and among the kind of people that he kind of delighted in taking down in his writing. And I think an important part of his dedication to the struggle was to what some other folks have already emphasized, was that just the sheer amount of time that he put into mentorship. You know, I was in my mid-20s when I met him. Aria Zahedi, my oldest friend in the left, introduced me to Lauren at the time when I was growing dissatisfied with the kind of like chic postmodernism, kind of radical liberal anarchism that I had just kind of fallen into in my teenage years. And I'm amazed now, looking back, at the amount of time that Lauren was willing to set aside for me and for other people. And I've been reading his writing over the last couple of days, just rereading some of these essays, and just be like, man, the amount of patience that it must have taken for this guy to talk to me when I was like in my mid-20s and didn't know shit about any of this stuff, but thought that I did, right? Just kind of patience and humility, and he wasn't getting anything out of that, right? He wasn't a wealthy man. You know, he did have the senior citizens discount Metro card, which I called the Insurgent Notes membership card. but he wasn't a wealthy man, but he made so much time for basically somebody who he judged would be, you know, important to reach. You know, the listeners might think that we're making some kind of joke about the Wendy's lectures, but no, I was present and I helped organize some of these. There were, in fact, there was a series of lectures in the basement of a Wendy's in Midtown Manhattan because we just couldn't get space to do it anywhere else. And so, like, to the soundtrack of, yeah, it was in the basement of a Wendy's. You know,
like where they stock the secret sauce and stuff like that?
No. There was a basement eating area, but it was oh, okay. there's a ground level entrance on Fifth Avenue, and then so there will be a plaque there someday, assuming that we don't abolish restaurants in the revolution. There will at least be a plaque to commemorate.
We can be a set piece. We can keep it just as it was when Lauren Goldner gave his 20 lectures.
No, and they were very much. It was a very serious set of lectures delivered in the basement of a Wendy's as like Rihanna blasted in the background. And the interesting part is that one of the organizers had been goading Lauren to do this series of all the different revolutionary tendencies as a means of inoculating younger comrades against the different groups that they were meeting in New York. And so the idea was that Lauren was going to explain to them why it was stupid to be a Maoist or why it was stupid to be a Trotskyist. And therefore they would inevitably see the infinite wisdom of whatever the fuck we all are, you know? And I remember it was really funny during the Trotsky one. This is when Lauren was supposed to be convincing all these younger people that there was nothing for them in Trotskyism. He would just go on these like really poetic tangents about, you know, and the real military genius of Trotsky. He's like, now think about this for a minute. This is somebody who had never served in the military before. He had no prior experience and he was leading battalions. He was routing the White Army left and right and just rhapsodizing about Trotsky and about the kind of begrudging admiration that he had for Lenin. Right. And the comrade who had imagined that this was going to just be one polemic after another, right, realized that Lauren was not somebody who thought that way. He could write very polemically, but he engaged in the revolutionary tradition in a very dynamic and dialectical way. And that was like around the time when I was trying to make sense of all these different traditions that bear proper names. And Lauren really helped me realize that people like Lenin and Trotsky and Mao were actually very dynamic and original revolutionary thinkers in their time who were responding to the rapid unfolding of world events and trying their best to figure out how to take meaningful action in it. And the fact that these names have been appended to these stale, ossified traditions over the years is no discredit to them, right? If any of those people were still alive today, imagine how disgusted that Trotsky would be if he came back and found out that his adherents were still presenting the transitional program as if it was a document relevant to the 21st century, right? And so it was this kind of dynamic engagement that Lauren really modeled for a lot of us. I could go on and on, and probably will at some point, but I guess I just want to say in closing that it's really scary to think that, you know, we're losing this generation, the 68er generation. You know, Ignatieff passed a couple of years ago. He was like our Gramsci. We've lost Lauren. He's our Bordiga, right? If anybody's in New York, please bring some chicken soup to John Garvey. John Garvey must be defended at all costs. It's going to be a crushing blow when this generation is just a memory to us. You know,
we asked and him to come on as a side note, and he's obviously mourning one of his great friends right now. So maybe sometime in the future we can have John Garvey on to speak more. But I'm sorry, go on, Jared.
Oh no, that's fine. And I was just going to say, in closing, like it's actually like. There's a lot of responsibility, you know, I think that falls on those of us who had the privilege of interacting with this older generation. And I'm not sure, like, I feel like conflicted that I could even, you know, rise to the challenge of just being for a new generation what Lauren was to us, right? And it's like, it's almost a burden or a challenge, right? And I think that the good news is that this is, Somebody like Lauren has modeled this for us in a very clear way, and will kind of shine a path forward, especially for those of us who might be a little bit isolated from day-to-day struggles. I mean, as Noel liked to point out, Lauren in his life was never involved in an issue-based, demand-based political campaign, and it didn't fucking matter. Because he was able to exert so much influence on people engaged in struggles all over the world, right? And so I think that there's all kinds of ways that people can interface with the movement, and there's all kinds of responsibilities for people who understand that the communist revolution actually needs to happen, right? And Lauren was just a wonderful example of something that's really necessary. And it's like Arya was saying, it's an absence now, and I worry that his absence just can't be filled.
Well, it's up to us to try, I suppose. Joe Lombardo, do you want to introduce yourself and say some words?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Joe. I first emailed Lauren probably in 2009. I was in Turkey at the time, and I was coming back to the U.S., to New York. And he wrote, you know, he had his article in Turkey and stuff, and I just found it very enlightening at the time. I found myself in this weird, you know, hodgepodge of Leninism and Stalinism and, you know, things that I kind of picked up, I guess, along the way. And so 2010, I came back, and I think it was at the second meeting of IN where I joined. And I think it was at some bakery, I think in the Lower East Side. I can't remember, but I remember, yeah, Arya shaking his head. Yeah. So I remember that's where I met Arya. Sean, I don't know if you were there at the time, maybe. Definitely both Johnny and John were there. Yeah, I'm trying to think who else. Jacob? No, I don't think Jacob was there. But anyway, I think I met, you know, Sean and Jake and Arya. I think at Spain at one point, maybe even Jared was there. I'm not sure when that restaurant apparently closed down. And I was like, that was kind of like my dinner most nights because of the.
That was a huge loss. That was like the main meeting place. We're trying to have a commie meeting next week. And I was like, oh, let's go to Spain. Oh, damn, it's gone.
Yeah, exactly. I think they might have been fascist, but I'm not sure. But anyway, you know, I can't speak intelligently. It's been years, really, since I've sort of been out of the movement now. But so certainly, you know, folks like Arya definitely can, I think, speak to Lauren's legacy in a very intellectual way. Lauren, for me, was, I'll always remember him, you know, kind of tottering, you know, somewhere down, you know, 4th Street in Manhattan, you know, with his big oversized headphones, this backpack, this ill-fitting clothing. And, you know, I remember asking him, what are you listening to all day? And he's like, oh, it's Mandarin lessons. So I said, okay. And so we would be at this diner, and some folks have already spoken about this, but he was such an omnivorous reader. I mean, you know, really one of the few, I think, on the left that just wasn't, you know, fixated on every emotion of what Lenin said or Trotsky or even Marx for that matter. I mean, I think half the time we'd speak about his interest in French poetry, art, certainly language for sure, his readings into science. And I remember being about, I guess, maybe 25, 26. I'm like, my God, I'm like such a dumbass. Like, what is this guy even doing? Bother talking to me. I can't contribute. Like Jared said, it's like, what am I going to contribute to this conversation? And I think we would spend maybe like 3 hours and we would meet almost every week until I left New York. So I knew him for, you know, a good decade or so. And I just remember the IN meetings. It was maybe only six or seven folks. Sometimes different people would come through and talk. And, you know, Lauren, he was also someone who was not, even though he might have been maybe dogmatic in some ways, you know, he always pointed you in the direction of other people. And I think for me, what was interesting is I got to know Walter Daum, you know, as a sort of left-wing trot. McIntosh was one person I met with, a couple other folks, these names are now slipping me, you know, that weren't necessarily even empathetic to, I'd say, Lauren's view, but he would still kind of point you in the right direction. And just one hell of a listener. I think for me, at least at IN, I was definitely the slower one of the group. I don't think I really contributed too much to the intellectual development out here, Aria or Lauren Talk or Garvey. And I'm like, oh man, it's like, I'm just going to sit here and eat some dip and just listen to these guys. But it was always a good time. And you know, the one person I kind of, I wish was here was probably Shimon, because I think Shimon also was someone who was very fluent, who could really speak to Lauren's level and had a huge influence on him as well. And it was working with Shimon with some of these kids from Queens, I remember, for a while. And Lauren was, you know, we're always pointing the direction of Lauren. If these kids had some big theoretical question, I'm like, I can't answer value theory. You know, talk to Lauren Goldner or something like that. You know, and Lauren would be there. He would come to you, you know. And I think that's very unique, you know, where I think a lot of folks in this generation have been sort of brittled and just wanted to kind of talk and give you the party line. I think Lauren was kind of a mix of the two. So I just remember him, you know, just telling all these anecdotes, but just maybe to sort of lighten it up, I remember, at least I laugh at this, you know, two stories he tells. One was, maybe it was during the Nixon administration with price controls, and he was out, it was a steelworkers strike. It might have been in New York, I think he even mentioned DC, I can't remember. But I mean, you know, Lauren, as some of you may know on the call, it was not a very big man. And so he was pushing his way through the steelworkers, and he had a sign that says, you know, for socialist revolution. And at one point, you know, those two steelworkers look over, and the one guy nudges the other. It's like, yo, that's some wacko shit right there. So, and the other one was, he was never a fan of industrialization, the policy that I think a lot of people like Hal Draper in the IS tradition have. This is when he was still in Northern California. But I guess at one point in the summer, they were doing like these brief, almost like internships, industrializing in local Bay Area factories. And he was on the assembly line, I guess, and there was one of his comrades was next to him, and he was next to another worker, and they're always trying to find, you know, a way to kind of talk to these guys and all that stuff, a little nervous. And so his friend, you know, goes to this one worker. It's like, hey, it's like, who said workers of the world unite? The guy looks over him and says, I don't know, Ralph. So, you know, just things like that that were kind of like fun. And then the last story I could tell that was also kind of fun as well, it might have been during this period too, was, you know, when these guys were industrializing, it wasn't just the IS, it was, you know, some sort of proto-Maoist faction or Stalinist. It was, you know, a whole hodgepodge of kids from Berkeley, basically. And, you know, all of them were trying to, like, you know, sort of stay silent, see who's trying to fill each other out a little bit. And I guess at one point, some of the workers sort of, you know, caught wind of what they were, the literature that they were passing out. And one of the guys, this poor worker, says, well, why did the Soviet Union degenerate? All of a sudden, an explosion of all of these comments. Well, it was because of Stalin. The Stalinists are blaming the Trotskyists for it, you know, all that stuff. So he just had this institutional knowledge, these anecdotes that I don't really think my generation, I guess our generation, we're probably all relatively the same age, you know, really had. I think Occupy was pretty formative. But when you look back at what Goldner had to go through in the 80s, for example, I mean, man, that must have just been, you know, awful. And, you know, he was someone who, you know, I think about some of his reading groups and trying to keep up. And then, you know, I'd always lie to him. It's like, oh, did you read volume two yet? And I was like, yeah, I read it. And, you know, of course I never did because I couldn't get past the first 50 pages. So yeah, you know, my kind of commentary is sort of everywhere. It's just sort of remembering the guy. It was sort of strange though, because I had texted Sean maybe about a week ago or I don't know how long ago, just saying, hey, you know, what's, has he ever heard from Lauren? Because I know in 2014 or so, when we had met up, he had said he had cancer. And he was very stoic about it. And I don't think he really wanted to hear me, you know, so how are you, blah, blah. I think he just wanted to, you know, put it out in the ether. So I would have kind of, I don't know how public he was with that. I guess he probably told all of you to a certain extent. But he really struggled with that for, you know, several years, I guess. I don't know if he succumbed to it. But that was something that did not stop him. He was still an intellectual powerhouse. He would still read. He would still learn languages. I mean, you know, just an incredible figure. So I'll stop my ramble now. But, you know, he was a friend, too. You know, we talked a lot about personal stuff too in the 10 or so years that I knew him. And the last time I talked to him was probably in quarantine. And, you know, I called him up and see how he's doing. And, you know, he just talked about China and his, you know, his big work on financialization of American capital. And, you know, at the time I'm sitting there unemployed, I'm like, oh, cool. But, you know, so I don't know. Rest in peace, man, you know.
Thank you, Joe, so much. To close out this Lauren Goldner Memorial episode, I'm not going to say anything particularly original. I was taking notes on what everybody said, and a lot of the points converged. So collectively, what we've said about Lauren Goldner is that his critiques of fictitious capital and the critique of political economy, this thread of critique that he kept alive all the way back from the 1960s was essential. His understanding of alienation, his critique of ideology, whether that be the ideology of post-colonialist anti-imperialism or the ideology of dogmatized Marxisms of the past that have been handed down to us. He was a constant critic of the dogmatization of theory. He offered and proffered a dynamic and dialectical, non-dogmatic Marxist vision, but one that was grounded in the principle of real working class struggle and the lives of working class, of the proletariat across the globe. I guess the last thing I'd say is that we should all be inspired by Lauren's life, and we should all hold his legacy close to us. And of course, as you all know, this isn't just a memorial for one man. This is also, of course, his life and legacy is a call to action for all of us. I'm not saying that you need to learn six languages in the next few years or so. I'm not saying that you need to be a positive revolutionary influence on absolutely everybody you meet for the entirety of the rest of your life, that you have to live all over the globe and meet people all over the globe and engage with the working class struggle day in and day out, always and everywhere. But that is what Lauren Goldner did. And he did that for us. He did that for the working class. He did that for the world. He did that for humanity. Because above all things, being a revolutionist, being a critic, and being a theorist, he was a lovely and dear human being and a dear friend to us all. So everybody, thank you so much for coming on this episode to say your words for Lauren. Lauren Goldner, rest in peace.
Can I tell you one thing, Sean?
Yeah.
For people that are just maybe just starting to listen to the podcast and never knew Lauren, if you never knew him, if you never knew him, well, your life is poorer for that, but he knew you and you were the sole focus of his life's work.
Absolutely. Your struggle.
This is work that we will ensure goes on. No one can fill his shoes, but the work will continue. I mean to see that it does. And Lauren himself would tell you, I can fake it. So
that was
we will break their haughty power.
Break their haughty power. Absolutely.
Rest in peace, your grace. Hasta la victoria siempre.
I just found this email that he sent me at like, I sent him some email like, oh man, I'm really getting disillusioned with all this Foucault I've been reading. And he just responded at like 2:47 in the morning. The dialectic will make you whole.
Legend. Absolute legend.
Joe Lombardo says he was, it's hard to fit in with the Intelligent Notes and with all these intellectual powerhouses. I was the typesetter.
Oh, no, no. Look, I don't want to misrepresent. I was also a bougie academic from the New School, too. Don't. I don't want to misstate myself here. Although I remember Ari and I had one class together, and I remember I think we were the lone Marxists, and Ari was going hard against the professor on misinterpreting Hegel. So I always remember that.
You don't remember the name of that coffee shop, do you?
I don't remember that. I remember being at the meeting, first Insurgent Notes meeting with Garvey.
Yeah, this coffee shop we sometimes had meetings at was an old mafia hangout, like in the 40s. I forgot one of the famous, it was in the East Village, right? It was like on Avenue A or First Avenue or something like that. But I don't
know. Allen Street.
I think it closed down.
Going
everywhere
back,
that was cool in New York is closed, it seems.
Going back into his writings, you know, over the last several days since I heard of his passing, I was like reading a bunch of stuff that I haven't read in 15 years. You guys ever have this experience where like you're going back and reading something and you're like, oh, that's where I got this from?
Yeah.
Like, like part of the spirit of the Antifada was always like, we would bring up several times the kind of jokey thing that Lauren said, where it's like, back in the 70s, you could figure out what somebody's political tendency was by like the year that they thought the Soviet Revolution had degenerated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You kind of use that as like a, you know, like a quip or whatever. But I went back and read the article, and it's an article about Bordiga, and it's, I guess it's about the agrarian revolution. And within that like kind of jokey thing that we've been using is like a whole theoretical apparatus for understanding the degeneration of actually existing socialism and understanding it has like a developmentalist project, which comes out of like a bourgeois problematic of like capitalization of agriculture. Like the whole thing is fucking great. So I'm sure this is still going to go in the episode. We're going to make a whole, I have a whole list of the articles that people mentioned and we'll put more into, but like, even if it's been years and you're like, oh, I read Lord Goldner back 10 years ago or whatever, pick it up again, man. It is formative, formative stuff.
Yeah. That quip.
Go on. Sorry.
I was going to say like, I mean, there's a German writer, Bini Adamczak, who wrote a book called Yesterday is Tomorrow that quotes that section of, she's great. And that book is amazing, too. And yeah, it's almost like she develops a theory. She spins a theory out of that entire, just that premise. I remember, too, like, one of the first articles I read by him was his review of Pistone's Time, Labor, and Social Domination, because I'd been a student of Pistone. I was so impressed by it as, you know, one of the few, like, really, I think, compelling criticisms of Pistone that wasn't just trying to write him off as just like, oh, he's not interested in class struggle or whatnot. A very coming at it from a very deep, like, sort of Hegelian Marxist understanding, I was just, very impressed by it.
Put that one in the notes too. All right, Andy, what do you think? We got ourselves a podcast, a memorial podcast.
Sure. I mean, the anecdotes are great. I'm down to keep hearing those, but I'll leave it up to you guys.
Oh yeah, there's billions of those. Joe was talking about Lauren in his ill-fitting clothes with his big backpack full of books all the time. I think the backpack's the only thing that kept him warm in the winter, because I always used to say Lauren Goldner would give you the shirt off his back. But he really only had that one shirt. He wore it everywhere.
I just remember.
He wore that fucking thing everywhere. Winter, summer. That was his wardrobe. He was awesome. An absolute miser when it came to clothing. He was not a victim of intellectual fashion or fashion in general. At the very worst, coldest days of the winter, he might have a thin jacket or something, but man, he had that one shirt. He wore it all the time.
Yeah. And something I was thinking about, like, I think all of us are saying this, it's like, I think that generation of like 68, like ultra left, I don't know. I'm like, I think this is why this podcast is so important, right? It's like, how do we keep memories alive? Like, how do we build like some type of institutional memory, right? I felt kind of sad about thinking, you know, all of like what's going to happen to all of Lauren's work, right? Like, you know, some of it is on that website. I'm sure a lot of it has not been published. You know, and when we look at the right or like the liberals, they're like so good at building these institutions and, you know, keeping those memories. But I don't know. I just, it makes me a little sad sometimes, and grateful also for this podcast, right? For us to to talk about Lauren's contributions to newer generations and to hopefully continue that legacy of building with younger folks, because I think that's really important. Otherwise, it gets kind of lost, especially in the digital age, right? Like, how do we keep that memory alive? Like, all those correspondences, like all those debates, like, you know, the trajectory of like of ultra leftism, like, what is it? What does it mean? You know, and especially now, I think when it's so easy to claim to be like a revolutionary, right? But to maybe have some like liberal reformist politics. And I think Lauren was very critical of a lot of reformist strategies today. So I don't know. I just think it's really important to have this podcast and these conversations.
Well, thank you for that.
Okay, yeah, and you can punch this in or discard it, but I just really wanted to emphasize that Lauren was a really great example of somebody who had a very serious anti-system revolutionary line that was nonetheless faithful to Marx and Marxism. Something that I love about the Antifada and the work of everybody I'm looking at on the screen right now is the earnest attempt to kind of square this circle, to hold aloft kind of the promise of Marxism without succumbing to reformism or nihilism. And there's a great passage that I wanted to just pull real quick from the Vanguard of Retrogression, my favorite book cover of all time. And you actually can judge this book by its cover. he has this theory of the middle class radical. And I just to call back something that a few of you have said, just imagine Lauren having lived through the promise of 1967. He had to suffer through the 80s and 90s, and everything's just attacks, and Marx is an old heterosexual white man and all the rest of that. He's talking about the middle class radical. For the middle class radical view, the problems are hierarchy, authority, domination, and power. For the Marxian communist view, the problems are the project of the abolition of value, commodity production, wage labor, and the proletariat. The latter, of course, being the commodity form of labor power within capitalism. Right?
Boom.
And I mean, it's simple on paper, right? But I find like trying to make sense of the political terrain today, like the point of what we're doing, right, is the realization of communism, right? It's not a destructive act. It's a creative act, and it's latent within capitalism, albeit in all kinds of really ugly, nasty, one-dimensional ways. And I just really wanted to put that out there specifically for these younger folks that we're imagining listen to the Antifada, though I'm not sure if they actually exist. There's really necessary work to be done to really take seriously the anti-state, anti-system approach in a way that just does not succumb to just destruction, nihilism, and all the rest. And Goldner really shines the light forward for that.
As I say, the movement was running out of steam in the early 90s. And the Soviet Union, it was very surprising to me to hear this from various people that I met 15 some years later. It was experienced like the death of God in the 19th century in the West. Anyone who was around in the 60s and 70s in the U.S. or the United States knows that there were pro-Soviet elements, but the critique of Stalinism, of the Trotskyist form, the anarchist form, the left communist form was in the air and widely debated. Whereas in Korea, because of its different position in terms of overall capitalist development, much more open to the Stalinist forms I mentioned earlier, the Soviet Union just loomed large, even for people who were pro-China or pro-North Korea, in a way that was, we just didn't experience it here. So I met people who just went into seclusion when the Soviet Union collapsed. They just said, well, I guess socialism, communism is a myth after all, and it's just not possible. And there was incredible demoralization. And in a way that happened in the United States around 1970, a little later in Europe, people with middle class credentials that they could cash them in and became professionals and sort of privatized, and It was also at that very time that postmodernism in different forms, Derrida, Foucault, Lacan, you name it, suddenly started massively being translated into Korean, not from French, mind you, but from English, which is, I can only imagine what Derrida sounds like in Korean.
One of the things when you read his writing going back to the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the aughts, certainly before the great financial crisis, is the parlous state of the Anglophone and Western left, whether, as you said, those are reformists or whether they are some flavor of Marxism, Leninism, Maoism, Hoxhaism, whatever. And unfortunately, you know, what Goldner's critiquing in the 60s and 70s, it's maybe even worse right now. And so I'm not trying to make this a dour thing. It's actually kind of a hopeful thing. He was really alone for many decades, not alone as a person, because he gathered people around him, but alone as a dynamic thinker, as a critical thinker, as Jared said, somebody with like a counter-systemic analysis that was real and vibrant and attuned to the moments and the time. Despite being alone in that through like large swaths of decades, right? He pushed forward and he fought through it. And in a very real sense, when the financial crisis comes and there is a return to the critique of political economy, people start taking the proletariat seriously again, he was there. So he went through the muck and the mire of those decades of the Jesse Jackson campaign, of like voting for Walter Mondale or whatever shitty thing was happening in American politics. And his time did come. And we here, you know, on this panel are evidence that his time did come. So if you're out there listening, if you're one of these apocryphal young people, right, and you feel like, well, everybody around me is just trying to say that Hamas is the key to, you know, proletarian revolution, and I feel out of step with everybody in the world, blah, blah, blah. Just know that that can be your reality for a period of time. But Loren Goldner, by and large, was right about things for the last 50 years or so. And he found his people at the end, and he kept his voice, and he fought and he struggled till the end of his life to gift all of us the knowledge and his legacy, you know, that we're carrying with us. So it's a hopeful note.
Yeah, I will say, yeah, too, Loren, and I'm sure that that article is probably still available, his interview with South Korean, you know, communists, you know, they asked him, well, would you have done anything differently in 1917? He says, no, I would have probably made the exact same mistakes as Lenin did. And I think that's a certain humility that you're not going to find, at least in my forays with the ultra left, that no one would ever want to admit. And so I think that there is part of Loren where, you know, as some folks had said, he might have critiqued Trotsky, might have critiqued Lenin. But I think also, too, he kind of understood some of those, you know, stumbling blocks that he himself probably would have made had he been back in that time as well. And I think that's tough for a lot of folks to wrap their heads around in certain milieus. So for what it's worth.
Two things that Loren used to say a lot that I think, you know, kind of represent how he was, but they're very different. One was, from a simple scratch, you can get gangrene, which he meant if you let stupid, sloppy ideas in, they can soon kind of degenerate. He was talking about the movement generally. And then another that's I think about a lot, he says, it is often those who think revolution is right around the corner in high points of struggle that think revolution is impossible in low periods of struggle. So I'll end it on that for me.
All right, do we have a quorum to break up this meeting of the Loren Goldner Appreciation Society / Memorial Podcast? Like you said, we'll all meet up again soon. Thank you to everybody for listening to us and our thoughts. And we're going to, as I said before, put a whole bunch of links in the show notes. You should really check out Loren's entire archive, which will live on, and as will his thoughts and his memories. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn. But without our brains and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We will break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong, the course is solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms multiplied a millionfold. We will give birth to a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong. Dug the mines, built the workshops, endless miles of railway laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid these wonders we have made. But the union makes us strong. But the union makes us strong.